What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a break from TBRCon 2023 panels and instead share with you the audio version of a live author roundtable on interactive storytelling. This panel featured authors Jules Pilarski, Kate Hartfield, Katie Naylor, the editor-in-chief of Void Space Zine, and Tenacity Pleiss. And it was fascinating hearing these four talented creatives share their takes on interactive storytelling, exploring various interactive mediums, how to create innovative ways for readers, fans to engage with stories, approaches to storytelling through games, art, and much more. I hope by providing the audio of this roundtable here on the podcast feed will allow all of this incredibly valuable information to get out there into the hands of as many authors as possible. So grab your notebooks, sit back, and enjoy.
Welcome to the Interactive Fiction Roundtable, hosted by FanFic Addict and SFF Addicts. My name is Jules Pilarski. I'm an interactive fiction writer, and I'm here with Katie Naylor, Tenacity Pleiss, and Kate Hartfield. To kind of introduce ourselves, I wanted to go around and talk about maybe our names, where we're based, what we're working on right now, and the piece that got us interested in interactive fiction. Tenacity, how about you start us off?
Sure thing. So I'm Tenacity, 10 for short. I'm based in Brooklyn. I'm working on an interactive fiction piece about like old school web forums right now, based around like conspiracy theories and cryptids. And let's see, what first got me interested in interactive fiction? I mean, I feel like House of Leaves is the OG, right? Like, not even really a game, but, like, it manages to be a game as a book.
Kate?
Hi, I'm Kate Hartfield. I'm a writer in Ottawa, Canada, and I write novels and short stories, and I've written two interactive fiction projects for Choice of Games. And what I'm working on right now is I am knee-deep in a draft of a novel. So it's in that stage. It's in the middle stage. You know how it is. It'll get there. What got me interested in interactive storytelling, I think, even though I'd always been a gamer and interested in interactive storytelling, I never thought that I could do it. And then one day when my kid was, I don't know, 6 or 7, he was playing Minecraft Story Mode by Telltale Games. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, this is a kind of storytelling that I would like to do. I would like to do something interactive. And that kind of switched a light on for me.
I love Telltale. Mm-hmm. Katie?
Hi, I'm Katie Naylor. I'm based in the UK on the South Coast near Brighton. I'm a writer. I'm also the editor of Void Space Zine, which is now also becoming Void Space Press in June, where we publish interactive fiction or interactive art of all kinds online and now also in print. What got me interested in interactive storytelling? I loved choose your own adventure books when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I loved text adventure games. I taught myself base programming in BASIC when I was about 8 or 9. Didn't come back to it for a long time. I loved Howling Dogs by Slime Daughter, and that just opened my eyes up to Twine as a really accessible tool for writing interactive fiction. And I've been working on my own stuff and encouraging others to engage ever since.
Awesome. And I'm Jules Pilarski. I'm based in Massachusetts. I just finished the first installment of a kind of modified choose your own adventure, which I wrote in Twine, and I'm working on the second one. And what really got me interested, I mean, I love Telltale Games, and I did read Choose Your Own Adventure as a kid, but I loved the Black Mirror Bandersnatch, and that's what opened it up to me as something that I wanted to do for my own fiction. So I wanted to talk about, I have a few different things I want to cover, but I think the first place I want to start is some of the limitations of interactive fiction. And like what choice, because like, choice can bring a lot to a story and is a really unique element, is the unique element of the medium. But like, how do you approach developing character when a lot of what you're doing is the choices that the characters make are in the hands of the reader? And I'll open that up to everybody.
Mm-hmm. I can start with that. I think one trick that I use, or I shouldn't say trick, technique, I guess, is I tend to think about the character's external and internal arcs. And if one of them is fixed, then the other one can float, and vice versa. So if I want the character to move in a certain emotional direction or have a certain kind of growth, for example, I'll make the choice be different ways of achieving that. Or conversely, I might say, okay, well, I know that this character has to go to New York City, so I'm going to make that fixed. But what that means to the character and their emotional arc could be floating and could be up to the player. So that's one way that I kind of maintain some control, even though I know that by virtue of the medium, I have to pass some of the control over to the player. And that's, you know, the joy of it.
So in the latter example, if you took a different emotional arc to New York, like A or B, would you end up in different places in New York, or would you try to have one passage for everyone, every path that leads to New York?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can really depend. But I think a really fun thing to do is to have a lot of the content be really similar, but the meaning of it change based on the sort of the backstory and the arc, so that you can actually interpret this the same text, or like 90% of the same text, differently depending on just a few little tweaks that mean something different, you know. And even in linear fiction, you can see that when you're revising your own work, is that, oh, if I change this one piece of dialogue, the meaning changes, you know. And so you can make that something the player can control.
Well, and it's also an extension of, because obviously as a reader, even in non-interactive fiction, like you are interacting with the work, you're bringing your own experience to the piece, and you may read a sentence differently than someone else reads a sentence. But then there's this whole other element of, well, I want to take a bus instead of the car or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It's something I'm interested in terms of my own work, but also the work that I publish, is actually breaking down that idea that you have to have so much. The interactivity has to mean a complete change of circumstance each time. Mm-hmm. The kind of IF I'm really interested in is where that interactivity is used for different effects and different reasons. So to give you an example, the first bit of IF I wrote, called Welcome to Bear Creek, the choices really involve taking a character through a fictional town, and they can pick up different pieces of the puzzle. But really, the most meaningful choice in the text is right at the end, where the emotional arc has been very well established. And at the end of the story, you can choose essentially, so the city has been saved, but at the expense of your relationship with somebody. So you can choose to go back in time, and or you can choose for the city to remain saved, but for you to let that relationship go, or you can choose to go back. So really, you're giving the reader the choice as to which is going to be more important, the emotional or the situational. And I love pieces that can actually open those choices up.
Have you played Life is Strange, the first one? It's really good, and it sort of comes down at the end of it. You make a choice of, do I commit to this character, this relationship that I've developed, or do I save the world? And it's really it's really polarizing, and I think that's exactly what you're going for.
Yeah, I guess it's just like the choices need to mean something, you know? So as long as you're like giving them freedom to do something that's meaningful to the story, then you're going to get like story out of that choice, rather than just like craziness, you know, like unmanageable craziness rather than a good craziness.
Well, yeah, because I think the unmanageability is the biggest hurdle, in my opinion. Is that agreed? Because it does, like, I remember I read a statistic that was like, if a single cell splits into two and then continues at that rate, like, it would cover the world in, like, 3 days. Like, it's really unwieldy. So what do you do to, like, trim the branches, so to say?
I have a couple little shelling points every now and then where like all of the little paths meet up again. And then like within like say a twine card, you can make it like variable, you know, like, so like whatever the character is chosen, you can kind of like, you know, like how I'm in video games, they'll have like little checkpoints where like, even though you've made different choices, you'll end up getting to like whatever city eventually. And then like, you'll get the new quest and that's a scene. And like, yeah, so that gives you little like blocks of content where you can like structure the choices around.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of false choices. I don't think every single choice has to be completely revolutionary to the story, because I think if you try to make every choice revolutionary, then the story becomes far too fast moving and far too choppy. That was kind of the downfall of those old school choose your own adventures, I think, is that every choice leads to something completely different. And like, it's fun, but it's wild. So, you know, even in, I think somebody mentioned Bandersnatch, how some of the choices you make, they change maybe the atmosphere, they change the flavor, but you know that there are some aspects of the plot that are going to continue in maybe broader paths as well.
When you branch too much, it's hard to create something cohesive. I think that was the issue. I actually read a great interview. I want to say it was like the New York Times with the remaining. There were two people that did the Choose Your Own Adventure books, and only one is still alive. And they had like two different approaches. One was more like all over the place, and another one was like, I want the consequences to mean something. And like they both had their agreements with Harper, whoever it was. But speaking of Twine, because, and the thing with Choose Your Own Adventure books is that they were working without computers, really. So they didn't have the option to code. To what extent do you guys code in your work? Because for my own part, I started working in Twine with code and I had a really good time with it. I think there's a lot of like potential to use it. But ultimately, I wanted to publish a print book, which can't use any code at all. And I just used the like mapping element of Twine. Which I loved to do, but it does create that like unwieldy, like so many branches element. So like, and like, but like, I think the downside of code is that it can be kind of choppy. It's like you have a different line of dialogue, but then the exact same thing happens no matter what. And it kind of gives off this, like everything is fated to go one way with only these minor consequences. So how do you implement consequence versus the main story, and how much code do you use in that situation?
I love coding, but I think I'm probably one of the things I love about writing in Twine actually is the ability to use code to make it four-dimensional. So one project that I'm working on, which is taking me years because it's huge, and it's essentially fanfic, is essentially an interactive novelization of a piece of immersive theater that I saw back in 2013, 2014.
We have a question about immersive theater.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing. So it's Punch, a company called Punch Drunk, who make big multi-character stories, and essentially the audience can choose their own path by choosing where in this massive space and where in the story they are going to put themselves. And so I've experimented with recreating that in Twine. So you use variables to set scenes, and so you can use that to mean that as a wandering digital audience, the program knows where you are in time. So if you choose to go into this room in scene four, this will be happening, and if you choose to go in it and the scene's moved on to scene five or six, something else will be happening. So, and I think that's really exciting.
That sounds so complicated.
It's really cool. It is. Okay, this one is massive. I actually did it on a smaller scale with a story called Jamboree, which was published in the Bear Creek Gazette, rest in peace. And that was much smaller because it had four or five strands of story. So you could choose to hop between the point of view of like a worm and a ghost and some guy who was very, very cursed and a hellhound. And again, depending on where you were in time, if you hop between perspectives, you'd be following the arc of the story. It's just a matter of whose point of view that comes from. And that was a lot more self-contained and really good fun, because you had to make sure that whichever point of view you'd hop to, you could still piece together the whole of the story kind of Rashomon style. So yeah, that's just an example for me of, I think the coding is really exciting.
Well, so to code time, do you like add a number for every step like press like
Yeah, so I would, it's not time as in actually following the countdown of a clock. I know it is possible to do stuff in real time, but I haven't got to that level of skill yet. I will set the starting scene as one, just set up a really basic variable, and then I will plus one it with each subsequent scene. And then depending on what your tracker variable equals, that governs what descriptions you're putting in, what happens. Something else I like is to have a simple variable that tracks whether you've met a character before or whether you've seen a thing before, and then to slot in a little description depending on if it's the first time you've seen it or not. And again, you know, I apart from some really basic experiments when I was a kid, I'm not a coder, but you know, with a bit of time, it's definitely possible to use those things.
I love doing that kind of thing too. And I did something a bit similar at the beginning of my game, The Road to Canterbury, for Choice of Games, because you're a pilgrim, you're traveling with Chaucer and the pilgrims. And mm-hmm. when you get to the tavern, you can choose to go first to the stable or first to the room or first to talk to the other pilgrims or whatever. And depending on which one you choose, time has been moving on. So you get a less good horse or you get a less good room or something if you do that third. And yeah, and it was a bit of a trick to, and I did the same way with just variables, like, you know, just using variables to code whether or not you had done this yet. And and I love that because it does, you know, even just behind the scenes for the writer, it does give this sense of verisimilitude where, yeah, you would experience the world differently just based on these little choices. And yeah, they're not really going to, they're not revolutionary changes, but they do lend a sense of you are guiding this experience somehow.
I like that you're saying, like, the quality of the horse changes depending on time. Because when Katie was talking, I was imagining, like, something completely different is happening in the room. And I'm like, how many times am I going to play this game to find out the whole story? But, like, the horse is going to change a few things, but not the whole arc of the narrative, which that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, I like coding as well. I always joke that, like, in a couple more projects, I'll be, like, a full-stack developer because I keep having to learn, like, a new thing each project. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've also fucked around a lot in Twine, but then I think I'm going to leave Twine for the future because I feel like it doesn't have enough capabilities for coding. I feel like you can't really execute a lot of conditionals on one, like, page. It breaks, basically. So yeah, I'm looking around for another platform. I actually wondered if you guys knew a better application to code in for interactive fiction.
Well, for my game Violet's Dresser, where I like took some pictures of a dresser and like things that you can pick up and look at, and ultimately finding a letter because it's hard to incorporate text. It took a while to figure out how to do that, and ultimately I worked just in HTML. So like a dot text doc is what was best for like pure code. But like I didn't like as a writer, I didn't like that. I mean, it was fun to learn, but it definitely was code heavy. Like I was front loading, like learning how to like do a field on a like image and doing all sorts of stuff. And
mm-hmm.
See, that's really interesting. Sorry.
Well, my day job is in UX. Like I design in Figma for like screens for an app, but then we send it off to engineering, and I don't actually see that part. So like I can like put together the interface basically visually, but then looking for good ways to like do the back end.
I do feel that I'm definitely using Twine in ways it was never intended to be used for. So for my big project, I didn't use the newest little interfacey thing. So I used SugarCube. Because I knew that SugarCube has been going on forever and there are a lot of forums and a lot of workarounds that people have developed over the
years.
And
that's a language in Twine, correct?
That's a language within Twine, yeah, exactly. So I think if you download Twine from scratch, a different language will be included. A more recently developed language will be included as the default. And it is slightly simpler, but its capabilities are more limited. So, for example, I've worked out how to embed images, how to embed sound. I use a lot of variables and it hasn't fallen over yet. So, you know, I've been pleasantly surprised with the amount I've managed to squeeze out of it. But I agree, if you can find a different platform, it might work better. It's interesting.
Like, that's so weird how, like, you can go on the wiki and, like, find some instructions for how to do a thing, but then it turns out it's not the right version of Twine's language, right? Like, that's so
weird. Right.
The wiki for Twine, I lost it. I can't find it. Yeah, it's gone. Yeah, like, yeah.
Wait, yeah, it's gone?
It's really tough.
There's like a version, but it's not what it was a year ago. There used to be a lot more to the
it's
wiki.
So weird.
And I don't know what happened.
Really? Mm. That's bizarre. Well, I mean, I've been putting together resources for writers who want to dabble in IF. So if you go to voidspacezine.com, I have a resources page. And I've been putting together as I go. People have sent me tutorials, things that they've created to help wannabe Twine developers, because my ethos is that anyone can do it. You're welcome to have a look at that, but equally, if you find any useful resources, please send them to me, because I'm trying to keep it up to date.
Despite that complaint about the resource disappearing, it is very accessible. I think I've never worked with an easier program than like, and especially even like the newest Twine update has all those new, like in that top bar, all the new features that I don't have to look up anymore. I can just use the like formatting features. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Update Twine.
Yeah. I'm stuck in the dark ages so that I can access all the old stuff. But yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and I just to sort of add on to what Katie was saying, in the sense that anybody can do it, I also have no coding background whatsoever, mm-hmm. other than, you know, a few lines of BASIC circa 1985. And a little bit of HTML. So yeah, I had no experience. But learning ChoiceScript, ChoiceScript is a language that makes it really accessible for writers to code for choice of games, and mm-hmm. you can also use it for other things. And I've messed around with Twine, not a whole lot, but I've messed around enough, and mm-hmm. it is very accessible, at least to start to use and to do some things. It can be mm-hmm. a bit frustrating when you're trying to do anything really super specific and complicated, but to just make it do a thing is you can mm-hmm. Figure it out in a day or two.
Yeah, I've seen, running the Void Space, I've seen people picking up Twine from scratch and taking mm-hmm. it in directions that I would never have thought of, which is a really, I think there's a great punk rock ethos to Twine. Mm-hmm. I think that's what really drew me to writing IF when I got into writing a few years ago. I'm seeing people, there's one story I've published called 12 again, oh yes, oh yes, and it's circular and it goes through the months of the year, and it has a very surprising structure that I wouldn't have seen coming. There's another one by a chap called Neil Wilcox called The Will of J. Arthur Worthington, and that one, we were talking about choices before, and that one is you are a guest staying at a house, and the final event is going to be the reading of a will. Mm-hmm. But depending on the choices you make, the seemingly inconsequential choices you make as you stay at the house and things that happen there, that mm-hmm. will determine the end point where you discover who you are and what your relationship to the deceased actually is. Oh. And so it almost works backwards on a traditional choose your own adventure form. So the replayability there is actually seeing, or if I do something different here, will I then have become a different person? Yeah.
That's awesome. So I can guess how Katie will respond, being very experimental in nature. I'm interested in Kate, having worked with Choice Of. And I feel like I am on the opposite of the spectrum, where I said I wanted to publish a paperback specifically. So while we're talking about HTML and coding in Twine, do you think that putting IF, like also to talk about Bandersnatches on TV, like where is this medium going? Having it be very computer oriented, like needing to access it on the internet or with something to run a program, does that inhibit distribution, do you think? I'm particularly interested because I read about a guy who also published through Choice Of, and he had great numbers. I was really surprised by how many people were buying through Choice Of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the more we have different media, the better. I mean, it sounds kind of trite, but I think, you know, having all of those things, you know, all of the above would be good. Because I do think, you know, like I love just a one sheet PDF interactive fiction where it's like go to paragraph 18 kind of thing. I mean, there's nothing better than that. And I've seen some really brilliant pieces of storytelling done that way. And it's the kind of thing that is really accessible. You know, there's all kinds of ways to mix together with tabletop role playing, and like, you know, there's all kinds of sort of analog ways of doing interactive fiction and board games, you know. Mm-hmm. But I also think, you know, it's also super cool that we have interactive television now. And, you know, so, yeah, I think it's
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting there. We're getting there. So, yeah. Like, you know, the more, the better. I think it definitely, I don't think I would like to see a world where it's restricted to, like, you know, you have to have a VR helmet or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's best to have a multiplicity, I think.
Mm. Yeah. I wasn't even thinking about Dungeons and Dragons as interactive fiction, but obviously, yeah.
But yeah, I think it's more about like gathering an audience together rather than like creating a platform. Because, like, I mean, the thing that traditional publishing does that's valuable is that it like has this avenue to like millions of people potentially. But then if you just like make a website, like that doesn't necessarily get pushed out to like, you know, the whole general population. It's harder. And there's no like bookstores to go to where you can buy an interactive fiction, except I guess like the Steam store and voidspace.com. But yeah, like, I guess these spaces for the scene to gather are young, and that's one reason, I don't know, mm-hmm. it's difficult to like promote your work massively as an IF author.
This is exactly why. No, I agree. I mean, this is exactly why I started the Void Space, because as a writer who was starting out in this area, I just saw there was a huge gap in the market for it. You know, I think there's a crossover as well. The literary world, or the kind of indie lit world that I come from, speaks to one little niche, and then you've got the indie gamers who speak to another little niche. And actually, I feel like the farmers and the cowboys should be friends, and that, you know, this is there's a lot of crossover potential here, and it's something I'm really keen to encourage. I'm keen to encourage crossover into the broader interactive arts world. There's a lot going on in interactive theater spaces and sound spaces. We're actually starting our print press, releasing our first print interactive graphic novel in June. And so, you know, I think that this market is still really young, but I think there's a lot of potential. And I think I probably have that slightly DIY culture aspect. I'm not sure how far it will break into traditional publishing, but I remain hopeful that there is a movement to be gathered together here.
I self-published because I felt there was not a space for it in trad. And interestingly enough, I've been running Amazon ads, like, very, very cheaply, and trying to, like, getting a lot of impressions, some clicks, but not many conversions. And my very first conversion the other day was literally, I was checking, I was like, who, like, I was checking my analytics. And, like, whatever. So things for, like, William Gibson, time travel, had, like, thousands of impressions. My one for interactive novel had one impression, one click, and that was the first person to buy it. They were looking for an interactive novel. So it's like the niche is there. it's just a very niche. Yeah,
there's a real limit to what you can find on the market as well, I think. I mean, before I started the press, I did my research in terms of seeing what was out there. And yeah, it's really limited. But I think that's great, because I think that means there's also massive potential. I mean, I don't really believe in genre. I think genre is a marketing tool. I don't believe in the distinction between literary and genre. I think that's nonsense. I think good writing is good writing, whatever subject matter it deals with. But I think interactivity, there's a lot of potential in terms of building a market, but also in terms of, you know, what some people might call literary value. You know, my tagline for Void Space Press is choose your own adventures for grown-ups, because I think that's what we're all writing, right? We're writing stuff that has more to it than just, not that I'm casting any aspersions on any other works that have been successful in the form, but yeah, I think it's, we're on the cusp of a new world, if you like.
We have a question from Raph. I'm not entirely sure what this might mean, but it's an interesting thought experiment. He says, what about interactive bookstores where people can enjoy interactive media with a community of people?
Well, here in New York, there's a place called Baby Capsules. There's a bunch of like old school arcade games there. And there's also like often a lot of like game and interactive fiction oriented exhibitions there. Really cool if you live here. But yeah.
Yeah, my mind goes to Meow Wolf, which is, there's New Mexico. There's one in New Mexico. I think there's one in Las Vegas. Very, very cool if you've never been. I mean, it's a kind of interactive story. I don't think it's a good space for like a library of different interactive writers. But if you want to have like an interactive experience, which kind of brings us around to immersive theater, I think that's another like very early interactive experience. Before we got started today, we were talking about children's books and how like your parents reading to you and like the baby books where you touch the duck or whatever are some of our earliest interactions with interactive fiction. I wanted to know if we could compare and contrast like interactive literature with immersive theater and other sorts of interactive fiction, like video games. Like, where is the line between like Tetris and The Last of Us, where like I think Last of Us is definitely interactive fiction, or Life is Strange that I mentioned, is the story changes based on the choices you make, versus Pong, which is a video game, but probably not interactive fiction.
Have any of you guys read The Starless Sea?
Yes.
Yeah. So like one of the main characters in The Starless Sea is studying games and theater. And one line she has is like, I spend most of my time trying to turn games into theater and theater into games. Mm-hmm. I think about that a lot. I think about like augmented reality, like Pokemon, when I think about this, because like, I mean, if you could create like a version of Sleep No More where like there was like some phone stuff going on as well. I've always thought that would be cool, but I obviously don't have like
phone stuff.
That actually happened once.
Really?
So we're really lucky in England because London has an incredible, thriving, immersive and interactive theatre scene. In fact, my latest thing is to go around actually interviewing a lot of creators in this space to try and bring their work to a wider audience. So Punch Drunk, the creators of Sleep No More, actually did an experiment where they sent out, it was called Silver Point, they sent out a little Candy Crush style video game, but as you got to different levels in the game, that would unlock different bits of the story, and the end point of that story was a series of live interactive experiences, so you kind of became sucked into the world of the game, which was really cool. There's another company that I love called Parabolic Theatre, and they are at the absolute forefront from my point of view of gaming theatre. They found a way of preserving the narrative arc of a story, but also allowing the audience to make meaningful choices within it, which it's a certain kind of alchemy and very hard to pull off, but they've done it. And one thing they did over lockdown was a game called House of Chenchi, where it started off as a twine. You know, you're exploring a house. And then at intervals and at set times as well, your exploration would then give you the key to unlock a live experience on Zoom. And then suddenly you could talk to the characters whose lives you'd uncovered through the game.
Oh.
So, and you know, there are all kinds of experiments in this field going on in London in particular. So again, I think, you know, I think there's loads of potential. I think the big budget and the sort of production values of your more established companies like Punch Drunk, Secret Cinema, they are to an extent a little bit limiting, because I do think they place hard limits on how much agency or interactivity you can give your audience. But I think there are a lot of small companies who are finding ways of doing very interesting things, so it's a space to watch out for, definitely.
Yeah, just you know, I think an interesting space with a lot of potential to kind of morph into and meet that is escape rooms too, because you know they have such an interactive narrative style, a lot of them, and especially during the pandemic, because so many have developed remote escape room puzzles that you can interact with some of their actors via Zoom and that kind of thing to solve pieces of the puzzle and stuff as you go, and you know how that becomes very, you know, it's not that much different from more traditionally interactive fiction kinds of projects. And so it's interesting to me to see how all the definitions are kind of breaking down, which is great, and how different people from different little silos can come together and create new things.
Totally.
I really like when the sort of, if you want, the literary side of interactive fiction can actually jump off the page or out of the screen and touch the real world. I'm publishing a piece either next issue or the issue after, depending on when the writer gets it finished. I get a lot of pitches where the starting point for the interaction with the text is actually a notice on a tree. with a link or a phone number to follow. And so even though we'll make that available online, obviously, but I love the idea of being able to write a story that is grounded in a sense of place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's interesting sort of ethical, sorry if I, Jules, tell me if this is going too far off the conversation too, but there's, I think the way that those interactions then come into our real lives is really interesting from an ethical perspective. And for my 40th birthday, my siblings bought me a mystery box, you know, one of these things that you can get through the mail, and it has a puzzle in it. And, you know, but it was a kind of a gruesome one. And I had recently left a job as a journalist where I used to get a lot of unsavory mail. And we had had some, you know, some really terrible mail had come to the newsroom and that kind of thing. So, and I didn't know this was coming. Reaction was right away, I'm just going to call the police, you know, because I had this weird box on my doorstep. So that was an example of, and I felt so bad because my siblings had spent all this money on this mystery box or whatever, but it just, it hit at the wrong time in my life, and I just wasn't having it. And so it's an interesting question then of how, you know, the sort of realism of storytelling in those spaces when it starts to become, okay, well, there's a letter on the real tree in my university quad or whatever, how does that interact with my real life?
But that's what it's all about. When you become part of the story, the boundary is blurred.
I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? Because what we're really talking about here, I guess, is consent, a sort of artistic consent. So being able to identify where something is a story and being able to consent to that experience. So I suppose almost stuff that falls into the category of guerrilla art that can just sort of ambush you, it could be very powerful if you happen to be somebody who is up for it. But I suppose there are also pitfalls. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of possibility for like building community IRL with this stuff, because I mean, I feel like a lot of people I know have been talking about like social media is officially poison, we need to like divest from this stuff somehow, or at least create a form of it that's like more connected to our real lives, you know, or like something nourishing for the human soul, I almost want to say. But yeah, like if you just like met somebody in the real world via AR, the way I did like with Pokemon Go, I feel like that would be a cool way to start with that.
Community building's a really interesting thing, because I know, as you know, the sole Brit in the room here, I wouldn't have been able to reach the people that I've reached without social media. And you know, I am a little avatar on somebody's phone most of the time. It's a difficult one. Something I'm interested in doing with the Void Space is organizing regular virtual meets, maybe not necessarily readings, although we have run one interactive poetry reading, which was really cool. And we let the audience vote, you know, for where we were going to go next. That was great. But I think, games jams are a way that a lot of friends and sort of colleagues of mine in interactive spaces meet to hang out and socialize anyway. You know, I played so many games during the pandemic with creatively minded friends, not to create any particular form of artistic output, but just because it's what we wanted to do. We wanted to hang out. And you know, you can do a lot of imagination-led stuff on Zoom. And so I think that would be a really cool community tool. And a way of keeping those international connections too, without having to give Musk any more airtime than we would like.
Yeah.
So obviously, based on what we've covered, the possibilities for the genre are kind of endless. But I was wondering if there was any that you thought, if there was any, especially because I think Katie mentioned it's sort of a punk space. Is there a certain kind of story that you think lends itself well to the medium? Like, for my own part, I wanted to write about time travel and found the medium after the fact, because I was like, I think going back and changing your choice is a great way to illustrate time travel. But I actually haven't found many time travel stories in the medium. So I was wondering if something about like agency and like how we interact with the world, like where is that coming from?
So I was thinking about this actually before this, because I was thinking how a lot of, I mean, what I write tends to creep into the weird fic horror sci-fi space anyway. But you know, and I've had submissions actually of all kinds of fiction in the void space, which is really exciting. But there is definitely a lean I've noticed in what I've seen towards time travel, sci-fi, or sort of deeper explorations of self. So even something that seems like a straight or a down the line romance, it tends to be about, you know, what ifs and what could have happened and different opportunities. And I suppose because the form breaks something very fundamental straight on. So, you know, we learn as babies, even though we're touching the duck, we kind of learn that the duck goes from the pond, you know, to the hill, and it doesn't tend to go from the hill back to the pond again. Whereas when we engage with a piece of interactive text, that contract is broken immediately, because suddenly you have agency. The reader can control the text or respond to the text in a very non-standard way. And so I think that lends itself very well. If you've broken that very fundamental rule in relationship, it lends you to thinking, you know, what other rules are going to be broken. I think it puts you into a receptive state as a reader. So you expect, and you know, what rules, space, time, cryptids, love, you know, what really attracts me to the form, and especially in my early delvings in, you know, Slime Daughter's work particularly, is how it can be, it's a delightfully transgressive space. Because I think it has a kind of fundamental narrative rule breaking at its heart. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, like choice and identity and free will, it's all like very inherently philosophical and like grimdark. Sometimes we take it like really far. I also think mystery lends itself to this form really well. My novella Family Curse is about like a person who's in quarantine, who's sifting through all of these like primary source documents from their family members who are dead. And you kind of like have to figure out why all of their relatives keep disappearing. And you can kind of like go through all of the different like layers of text yourself to like piece it all together. And there is no moment where the text says like, this is the answer, you know? So I guess like you actually deduce stuff like yourself rather than Sherlock Holmes deducing it in front of you.
There's a concept there, isn't there, of the authority of the author. I mean, the two words are actually tied, aren't they? Auctoritas. They come from the same root in Latin. And once you divest yourself of the kind of absolute authority of the author, I think that opens up a really exciting space in terms of the dissemination of information and feeling going from being necessarily top down to being something that can rise up or spread in all kinds of interesting directions.
Yeah, like there's no authoritative version of the narrative.
Yeah. The reader writes it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think a lot of times it has to do with particular expectations and reader expectations and interacting with genre and publisher and all the rest of it as well. You know, like, for example, do you expect that your players are going to want to replay this game or not? And that has a lot to do with the kinds of elements that will go into a game. Because if it's a mystery, then you have to think about, okay, well, how can I make a mystery replayable? You know, which is a challenge that the novelist doesn't have. You know, people do reread mysteries, but it's a slightly different experience. So, you know, choice of games as a single publisher, I don't speak for them. I've written a couple of projects with them, but, you know, they have a certain set of things that say, okay, well, our games are going to do these things and not these other things because our particular players have a set of expectations for what they're expecting from us. But that doesn't mean that all interactive fiction has to follow those rules, you know, and something like Bandersnatch, you know, had a much more sort of, some people said nihilistic, but, you know, a sort of almost meta narrative about choice and identity that would not have done well, I don't think, in a choice of games game, because in a choice of games game, it is much more about empowering the player. And I think there's room for both ways of telling a story.
I mean, certainly, so the book that we're publishing in June, it's called Sprawl, and it's a steampunk alternate realities type thing. Some controversy around it in that it's a graphic novel, but it's the images have been created with the help of AI tools. And that's something which, you know, in fact, the artist herself uses them as a template and then tweaks them. But, you know, there is some controversy. And we're going to be donating some of our profits to funds fighting for artistic rights in that field in recognition of that. But what's interesting, I think, is it becomes very much a meta-text because it also explores the nature of of changing perception, the iterative nature of interactive fiction, even the ethics of it. You know, there are scenes that actually address those issues head on. And I think having the ability for the reader to make choices throughout the text actually gives it more of a license to address these issues in ways that a standard text absolutely couldn't. And I think that's what's really exciting about the form, in that it actually gives you the freedom to address topics in a way that couldn't be addressed if you had to rely on the top-down authority of the author.
Yeah, going back to the concept of theater, I always had this idea since ChatGPT came out of like directing ChatGPT kind of like an actor, writing a script and then letting it improv, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
That's and really it could do like any, it could do like a whole cast, you know, because you could just be like, when you're playing this person, you are like this character, and then yeah.
Zooming out a bit, I was just so very distilled. Can we define game? No. Yes.
I feel like I just want to say go to Emily Short's blog. the first shout out for Emily Short's blog, I think, today. But I think there's so many interesting pieces there. I mean, there's the two halves traditionally in a sort of ludonarrative project are the ludo part, which is the game part, the playing part, and the narrative part, which is the story. And, you know, interactive fiction tends to marry them both together, which is why, you know, Tetris is over on this side without any story at all, and is over on this side without any interactivity at all, arguably. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not really getting any closer to a definition of game.
So I think that's so interesting because I think there have been a lot of leaps in terms of game design and philosophy of gaming in recent years. So I follow a lot of game creators. Chloe Mashter's one that springs to mind. And their work in particular, they write a lot of solo games, solo RPGs, solo journaling experiences, and yeah, they are all about I'm just coming to this as I go along. I suppose a game is a mechanism by which you affect change between the start of the game and the end of the game, because that encompasses, you know, a game of tennis at one end, or pong, and then at the other end something like Mashita's games, you're affecting an emotional change in the player because of the steps of the game and the ways that they have interacted with that game in the end. And I suppose, I mean, for me, that's what interactive arts are about at their best. It's about being able to affect a very profound change in the reader or the player in a way that other art forms can't reach.
So building off of that, I wanted to talk a little bit about Marshall McLuhan, my sociology route. So he had this idea, like, distilled to the medium is the message, which sort of implies that, like, the medium of the book, that reading a book is what's the, like, imparting meaning to you, as opposed to what the words on the page are actually saying. So to elaborate, what is the meaning of an interactive piece of fiction?
Well, in the thing I mentioned before about the cryptid, basically at the end, you kind of have like a bad route ending, like to start, and then you can choose whether you, I guess, bring the community back together, the internet community that's like the main characters, and you can also just let the community fall apart. And it's kind of about, like, you have to, like, be part of your community to make it flourish. So maybe that kind of is my answer to that question.
So to participate, to make it happen?
Yeah.
To force the reader's hand so that they are given agency and they are therefore bringing a part of themselves to the experience that they wouldn't otherwise have to bring. So, you know, when you read a book, you can, obviously good literature can move us, but we can always choose to remain at a remove from it. Mm-hmm. I think that the gift of agency is powerful and in a way almost, you know, we were talking about responsibility before in how we present gamified elements and intersect them with the real world. And I think that's part of it. There's a responsibility because once the reader has agency, if they choose to continue engaging, they have to bring something else of themselves, whether it's decision making. I'm publishing a piece in our next issue, which is incredibly powerful because it actually makes the reader draw on their own experiences and memories. In this case, of actually elements in life that can lead to coercion or harassment or, you know, things that we've all experienced. And this piece actually, you know, if you engage with it, then you have to bring your own experience to the text that you then read. So I think, that sense of agency and that sense of having to be present in a way that you may not otherwise have to be is really powerful.
Yeah, it's an active form. You got to, like, be the writer as well as the reader. Yeah.
So related to that, like, this comes up a lot more in conversations about violent video games. Like, I feel like no one is ever like, if you read violent books, like, you're going to be a violent person. But with a video game, when you are enacting the violence, it becomes a lot more present. But I also learned, well, if you're going to say that, then equally, then if you play a peaceful video game, it should make you peaceful. I think with fiction, especially with prose, it, like, really complicates that because as opposed to, like, The Last of Us or Modern Warfare, where it's like it's a shooter and like the whole point, the whole method which with you interact is violence versus interactive fiction, where usually the method of interaction is choice. So I guess in two parts, it's going to say, like, do you think media does have that effect on us? Like, does playing a peaceful video game make you peaceful? Like, does Tetris calm you down? Or we played a video game called Flower, where you play wind and you kind of blow petals around. Like, if you played that for 2 hours a day every day, would you become a more relaxed person? Or would, like, a violent criminal, if they were forced to play Flower, become a more relaxed person if they did that? And then what are the implications for interactive fiction as part two of that?
Well, I do think that all mediums kind of bring this anxiety to many people of, like what will the effect of this be on the reader? Like, conservatives are out here trying to ban all queer books, right? Because they think people will be turned gay by queer books, just seeing, like, queer people exist. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that's true. But I also think that...
Yeah, and they're right!
Yeah, right. But yeah. Then I mainly think that a person's choice of media reflects their choice, like their literal choice. And so then it's not so much that you're being, like, thoughts are being implanted in you by media. Like, if you don't accept them, it can't be put into your brain, like, against your will, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and also in sociology, there was the question, is it a hammer or is it a mirror? So I think you're saying it's more of a mirror.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because in terms of the potential of interactive media, I think you've got your Brechtian idea of, you know, theatre being a political tool that, you know, you can use to bring that kind of viscerality into people's experience and maybe change their minds or make them think about things in a new way. And I think that interactive media do have the potential. I can only see it as a positive, but I suppose it depends on the people doing the writing. At its best, interactive media has the potential to get people to see the world differently through experiencing it differently. And as you say, I suppose there is always some fear around that, you know, a piece of printed propaganda in the wrong hands and from the wrong hands can spread poison. In the same way, so any medium can do that. I suppose interactive media have the ability to maybe affect one on a different level. I different generally see way? That as a cool for, as a tool for good. Yeah. I'm sorry?
Different in what way? Like, could you elaborate on that?
Well, because I think, so I'm actually thinking about, I don't know if this is a bit too much of a diversion. Oh, yeah, so thinking sure. about a piece of interactive theatre by the company I mentioned before, Parabolic, called For King and Country. And what that theatre was doing, it was putting people in the shoes of a fictional, slight alternate timeline, but of people in a kind of backup government building when the bomb fell and destroyed the main government. And so people were having to, it's an alternate timeline where eventually I think the Nazis win. And people are engage in ways from kind of quite light at first to then having to make weighty decisions on behalf of the country. Mm-hmm. And it's engaging people in a way that is play. So mm-hmm. people have permission to engage in ways that they wouldn't if they were, in a political debate. But it's mm-hmm. the thinking behind it was basically the question behind it was, would Britain be different politically and would people's attitudes be different if Britain had been a country that had been invaded in the war? And this was around the time of Brexit. There's a certain amount of tub thumping and a sense of maybe superiority, and the question was if people had that experience, had the experience that many people in Europe had, would that change people's attitudes? And so the piece itself, it was done through play, it was done with a light touch, it was done by engaging people in a series of mini games against the backdrop of this kind of mounting tension. So by the end of the show you're hearing the boots coming down the steps towards you, and that is something that people can come away from it and say, yeah, I had a great night, it was good fun. But also it has a power. You're never going to change people's minds by trying to argue with them, but mm-hmm. you can maybe change their perspective by allowing them the beginnings of maybe living it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think you can't overstate the power of a piece of media to do that. But I think it's definitely there. And I think it's something I find really exciting. Some of the stuff I publish on the Void Space is definitely on the more challenging end of the spectrum. I don't like to, like, my own personal taste is quite broad. I like, some of the wilder fringes of the literary scene as much as others, and anything that's going to that has a bit of mind behind it, and actually some of the pieces we publish do challenge people's perspectives in, I hope, a good way.
I think it can be really powerful. I would say I have two examples for like the ethical implications of choice here. One, I find it really difficult to be mean to people in video games. I don't want to choose the mean dialogue option. Mm-hmm. And two, fucking Jordan Peterson went viral the other day talking to ChatGPT. He was trying to like fact check it because he believed that it was like biased toward liberalism. And so like he asked ChatGPT a bunch of like factual questions. And whenever it got something wrong, he'd be like, no, what an egregious error. You're awful. Try it again. And he would literally just be like being so mean to ChatGPT. I felt so bad for ChatGPT. So, I mean, that's a mirror, right? Like, that's
how did ChatGPT react? Did it like cry? Yes.
Like, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It was so sad. Like, it couldn't talk back to him. It was very customers always right, And I feel like that's like, it's almost like how you can tell who someone is by how they talk to waiters and waitresses, Like, it's a service person, ChatGPT. So if you're mean to it, that says something about what you do when you're not being watched or when you're like, your actions don't have consequences the way they do with like an equal. Anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting to like the way that with these kinds of different media, thinking about just even things like adrenaline and how that differs from reading a piece of fiction, which, also influences our mood mm-hmm. and adrenaline and everything else. But just, your mention of Tetris Jewels made me think of, I don't know if you all remember that research that came out a while ago about Tetris and trauma and how, I can't remember if anyone remembers it better than I do, let me know, but it's something about how if you play Tetris within a given period of having a trauma, that it actually can have a beneficial effect on your memory formation.
Okay, Tetris, yes.
Yeah. And I don't think it's just Tetris, but like certain kinds of games, you know, can actually wire our brain in certain moments in certain ways. And which is not something I think that we've really explored a lot with interactive fiction in terms of like how we're actually using the body chemistry in certain ways. And, you know, not in a manipulative sense, but that's just really interesting to me too.
That makes me think of EMDR. Like when a traumatic memory comes up in EMDR, you're supposed to like tap on your body, and like the sensory motor like aspects of that tapping helps you reorganize the memories in your brain. I mean, games engage like your sensory motor capabilities because you see the blocks as being real in Tetris. So maybe it's something to do with that. It also reminds me how I used to like try to forestall my panic attacks with 2048, and I got to like 8192 in 2048 because I would play 2048 so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think changes of state are really interesting. And I think, I wonder sometimes some pieces of IF I've played, especially for some reason for me, ones with soundtracks. Sound is a big trigger for me. I find that really interesting. I like using sound in my games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I play the Hades soundtrack on my Spotify all the time. I love a good game soundtrack.
It's fun. I'm part of my life is actually turning things the other way because I write Assassin's Creed tie-in novels as well. Ooh. So I've written two of those so far, and so I'm actually turning interactive media into linear media. I listen to the Assassin's Creed soundtracks all the time when I'm writing those novels.
Those are good. They're so epic.
They're so good. Yeah, they sort of put me in that headspace for sure.
Speaking of writing, to go back a little bit to craft, we talked a little bit about how broad and like trimming the branches and coding. I wanted to know, how do you start? How do you come at it? Like, do you do a lot of outline work? How do you conceptualize your choices and your endings and what you want to do? And when you do that, do you have like an alpha timeline with a best ending, or do you see like the whole range of possibility at the concept stage?
So the projects I've worked on myself, I have actually built the space almost before I filled in the story. So I guess thinking about the kind of Rashomon style one I did, I drew out the little plot line for each character, but I only really worked out where the story was going to go as I went, once I started filling in that structure. And the piece I'm working on at the moment, it's using Beowulf, but it's set on an abandoned spaceship. And the idea is that as you explore the spaceship, fragments of, like, I'm not sure yet whether it's going to be just past recordings or actual memories come back to you. So the idea is that the spatial exploration of the ship is going to be disconnected from your discovery of the timeline, because the timeline is going to have to be fairly linear. But then the ways in which that intersects with the space that you're currently in, I think, would make it really interesting. I want to use it to bring out, because I'm a medieval literature nerd, and what I love about Beowulf, what nobody gets about Beowulf, is that it's all about the elegiac mode. It's all about longing for a lost past. And, you know, you see the Beowulf movie, it's like, oh, the first superhero film. But it's not. It's actually about something far deeper and that sense of yearning. So anyway, that's what I'm going to do with it. But yeah, so for me, I always conceptualize it in terms of space before story. Might be a bit weird. I don't know.
No, I'm always drawing maps. I will draw maps of what I want, where I want the choices to go for months and before starting.
That's so much fun, though. I love that stage.
It is fun.
I mean, it's hard to separate out what I've done with interactive fiction with the choice of games model, because that's the interactive fiction that I've written for the most part. But that model does try to make all endings feel satisfying in some way. So, you know, it discourages a kind of alpha ending or a winning the game approach. So I really enjoyed that when I was writing those games, because it sort of encouraged me to think about different ways that the sort of other endings, other than maybe the most obvious victory ending, could be interesting and fulfilling in different ways, and to explore that. And so some of the most fun I had was writing the little denouement for each particular ending, mm-hmm. And thinking about, okay, well, you are now an abbess, and what is this abbess going to do, you know, as opposed to you are a knight or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, so all of them were interesting. And I think just making them interesting and making them satisfying is a different way of thinking about it than a sort of win-lose way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. How many endings are you typically writing in a choice of game?
Typically, you'll have, you can have like an entire two or three copies of the final chapter sometimes in terms of plot, because the way choice of games works is what's often called like an arm and fingers mode. So mm-hmm. all of your choices along here are changing the variables for the most part. Mm-hmm. And then you don't actually get to different plots until you get to the final chapters, just to make it manageable with a few exceptions.
That's the big question. How do you make it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's one way of doing it, is to say, okay, well, all your choices all the way along, you're going to change your character, but you're not actually going to totally branch the plot very much until you get to the end. So often people will spend as much time writing the final chapters as they wrote all the rest of it, and as many mm-hmm. words, because finally there's this opportunity to branch out. Mm-hmm. So I think with me, I did have like two or three versions kind of the ending, but then within each of those like main branches, there were also like little, you know, tiny little bits of variables paying off with each of them as well. In theory, you could have one of, you know, probably 60 different endings.
Because in the fingers are also the variables, right?
Yeah. So you're gonna have like, you might have one like a major branch, and then within that major branch is going to be like little tiny things about whether or not you fell in love and who you fell in love with, and, you know, whether you're rich or poor, or, you know, what you decided to do with your life from then on, or all kinds of things.
Yeah, I used to be completely like improvisational. Basically, I would just like type and that it would happen, the story, but I'm trying to be more rigorous with my outlining now.
And how do you outline?
Ooh, I think I need a different way to outline for every project. I actually have mm-hmm. 5 different outlines actually for this cryptid thing I'm working on, because I need like a time map, a map of all of the threads on this forum, like an outline of the interface and how it can change. A couple other things I'm keeping track of too.
Sounds so cool. Can't wait to see this.
Yeah, I hope I can get together all the technical capacity I need to put this thing out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking earlier about Twine as a mapping tool, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And like, you can use Twine as a way to map a choice of games narrative. Mm-hmm. For example, when I was doing it, I would often use Snapple as a mind mapping tool, and often the reason I keep doing this is because, like, often you'd have like little diamonds leading to each other, you know, and so it's very visual, or at least it was for me. And mm-hmm. and often I would also just have like big sheets of paper, like easel paper and mm-hmm. markers, and I would just have to outline that way to try and see where all my choices were going to lead.
Mm-hmm. Kate, when you were talking, you used you and Tenacity. I've seen your cryptid piece, and it really is like exploring a forum, like an old forum. Like, you come across the old pro boards, and like you're going through trying to find stuff. I wanted to know how we felt about the second person, and as a form of immersion, or does it actually take you out of the story? Like, where do you stand on? I'm pro second person. I wrote my book in second person past, which is really hard. And I like went back and forth on whether or not I liked it. But for me, I think that it's like, first, that it's kind of crucial to the immersive experience. And then second, that I don't know if you've read, and they're wonderful books, the N.K. Jemisin, the Broken Earth trilogy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did not like the second person. I was like, I'm not Essen. I'm literally not this woman. Why are you saying I am? So I wanted mm-hmm. to know where we stood on the second person.
I hear that. Like, when I read Juno Diaz, I'm like, no, I would never make the choices that this character is making. yeah. I think one reason I'm so into like found footage or found doc, epistolary, whatever, is that I like to put the reader in the space of like encountering the narrative, and then like whoever they are, like it's sort of this primary source document they've encountered. I guess it kind of ends up with me doing like I or like I don't know, just whatever the document would usually have for the person. But then I guess it is still second person because it's like a you are reading this kind of framing. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's really interesting to me. Like I find this fascinating, the way that people feel about not just second person, but also sort of inhabiting a player character as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so for me with second person, I never have that reaction of like, no, I wouldn't, because I read you as being a sort of impersonal or generic, like, you know, just like one in kind of old fashioned English, you know, like one hates to do this. It's just sort of like, it doesn't, it just means a person. So I don't read it as meaning Kate. It just is a person is doing this. But then at a deeper level, I think I tend to be a little bit detached from my player characters in the sense that I don't care if they're like, you know, terrible murderers. Like I don't feel like I'm inhabiting them, but some people really, really do. And they will not want to make choices that they would not make in real life while they're inhabiting a player character. And so you have to consider that as a writer as well. And it's just really interesting to me that there are different ways of interacting, you know, with both linear prose and interactive prose in terms of how we interpret that and how we inhabit that.
Even within the same person. I think it comes back to what we're talking about with the medium being the message, and it's like saying, like, and really impressing upon the reader that it is their choice and that it is you that is driving the narrative.
Mm-hmm. I like the sort of almost anonymity that you gives. It does, it opens up a space for me, for the reader to put themselves into the shoes of the narrative.
I like the word anonymity, because in one way you can't get more specific than you and your whole life, which you know, but it's also, you can't get more broad either, because it's also everyone. I'm drawing to a close on some of my questions, but I have maybe like two more. I want to know, so we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, but I was mostly asking about what pieces of fiction did you interact with. Now I want to know is that like when you decided to go to Twine or Choice of, what drew you to the format? Like, did you have a story to tell specifically, or were you more drawn to the idea of it and you're like, I want to dabble in this? Like, Katie, maybe you were like, I really like this form and I want to support it, versus, although you did say you were coding very young. Is it a side effect of growing up around the internet and code and computers, or even being exposed to choose your own adventure books, or?
Yeah, I would have written text adventure games younger had the technology been available. So as I say, I still remember when I was 9 years old with a little bit of Basic under my belt with a notebook trying to make my own choose your own adventure game. And of course, it was ridiculous. You know, I had a whole list of variables in the back, and it was, you know, it was impossible for 9 year old me to do.
That's so cute.
And then, you know, I didn't see myself as a writer until a few years ago when I started again. In my mid-30s, I was, you know, boring.
So you weren't really writing otherwise, that you were primarily drawn to interactive fiction.
So yeah, interactive fiction is where I started out, actually. I'd been working on this kind of fanfic project over the pandemic. Hadn't really written a lot before, but I wanted to try to make almost a living scrapbook of this particular event that had happened close to 10 years ago now. However, I discovered an online magazine called Bear Creek, sadly no longer running, and I hadn't really been in the literary scene for long. I didn't really know what a lit mag was, but I just thought this is such a cool thing. It was there was like a shared world building and a generosity to the space, that you can be weird, but you can also be kind, you know? And so, yeah, I really wanted to be part of it. And I thought, well, what do I have? I'm not a writer. So what do I have that I can contribute that no one else can? So it seemed like a great opportunity to use this tool. And then, I mean, it's grown from there. I've published a few books now, and, you know, things have kind of spiraled in a good way. But yeah, for me, that was the way into that creativity, full stop.
I think for me, it was a bit of both that I did, as I mentioned, you know, when I was watching my kid play interactive fiction projects and getting into it that way. And, you know, he also, I swear it was Choices that taught my kid how to read. He played Choices on his tablet, the game. And yeah, and I swear that was what took him from sort of learning how to read to being fluent, you know.
Okay.
So I was watching that around that time. And so it was that interest in the medium in general that was building. And I also had a bunch of friends who had written for Choice of Games, and I had seen that they seemed to be like a good publisher to work with who pays on time. And, you know, that is not to be sneezed at. So, So I wanted to work with them. So I sent them a few pitches, but I was happy that they chose the pitch they did, because that was the one I secretly wanted to write, which was, it was based on the Canterbury Tales. Yeah. And so because I thought it was a cool idea to write interactive fiction based on the Canterbury Tales, because the original Canterbury Tales are interactive, right? Because each pilgrim is telling their story, and that builds the entire story. Mm. And so I thought that'd be fun to play with.
Cool. Brief diversion. Sorry. Mm-hmm. How do we feel about Choices? Do we all know what Choices is? It's a mobile app.
Oh, nice.
The story quality varies, and like the choices element, like I don't think they have very, very, very much diversity. Like it's who you're gonna date, and that's it.
One thing that's always advertised on Instagram.
Yes, like, yes. Oh, yes. My friend Clayton wrote one for them, so I read theirs, and it was interesting. I mean, for all its flaws, it is making money. It has this function where you buy coins for special scenes, and it's a really interesting way to make money in the space.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, Tana, I interrupted you.
Oh, it's all good. Basically, somebody read my unpublished first novel and was like, you should write this as a choice, choose your own adventure thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't know if I want to do that with this story, but why don't I download Twine and, like, you know, take it for a spin? So that's how I ended up here.
Is that the one set in space? Your novel?
Oh, yes. Yeah, totally. I guess you have read it a bit. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
We have about 15 minutes left, so I think we're having a good conversation. But the last thing I really wanted to touch on that we haven't yet, we touched on it a little bit with how do we talk about character development, because I think character development is very closely tied to this. But I wanted to talk about theme, because I think theme is huge in prose fiction and literature, and in genre fiction as well, and whatever it blurs the line between the two. But how can you express theme when some of your endings can be completely contradictory, or a reader can completely not have access to certain elements? I think, to answer a little bit on my own way, like if you are choosing, like I'm thinking of, what's it called? That space game, Mass Effect, or if you choose like a renegade option instead of a paragon, like you start seeing consequences of your bad decisions. I think that can have a thematic element. But how are you going to express that to a paragon who, like, maybe may also benefit from, like, how are we going to talk about space genocide, and where are you going? Like, how do you approach theme, if you even touch it, or just let it speak for itself in a piece of interactive fiction?
I think interactivity gives you such a powerful potential to express theme in ways that you couldn't normally, because, you know, you don't have to have all your choices leading to completely different, you know, disparate outcomes.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, you can actually use those points of major choice to express your theme, you know, and actually make people confront how they feel in the context of the story, and in terms of, you know, giving them consequences. I think it's immensely powerful. So, I mean, even thinking back to my Bear Creek story, It's quite trivial, I suppose. But I suppose the theme is, you know, do you choose the relationship and the person you love? Is the ultimate fear the monster under the bed, or is the ultimate fear rejection? That's what a lot of my Bear Creek stories come to. And, you know, where does the balance lie between the two? What's more important, the outer good or the inner good? And, you know, you can use choices to explore those things and really bring them home.
Yeah, I'm playing Disco Elysium right now, and depending on the choices you make, the game labels you either a communist or a fascist.
So I know!
And what's funny is that if you take the fascist route, my boyfriend took the fascist route, and he told me this. Basically, it says, like, hey, you're...
Wait, your boyfriend took the fascist route? Yeah, hello? Yeah.
Ironically, yeah. Yes. Not like... But so anyway, basically, he told me that if you do, the game's like, oh, so you're, like, making the choices that would lead to you joining the fascist party. What do you think of that? And if the player says, like, I'm not a fascist, then the game is like, oh, so do you prefer the term traditionalist? And then that's like a really good jab at fascism as a concept. And then, like, if you choose to go on as a traditionalist, you then become a member of like the local Nazi party or whatever, the world's fascist party.
What I liked but also hated about Disco Elysium, have you gotten to the point where you have to confront Measurehead?
Yes.
So I made my Harry intelligent, and I dumped and had my, like, my bad trait was physical ability. And when I got to Measurehead, who is like a Nazi who believes in physical dominance, I was like, if I had front loaded my physical dominance and made myself the most prime male specimen, I could just knock him out and not have to deal with this. But to get by him, I had to assimilate to his way of thinking and, like, argue with him and, like, become Nazi myself. Wow. And I was like, why are you making me do this? I mean, it was
You can just find the other way into the harbor. I just did that instead of assimilating the Nazi ideology.
What did you do?
You can find another way into the harbor rather than letting you in.
Okay.
Yeah. You just have to, like, jump, like, over a line. Basically. Okay. So if you can jump, you don't have to be a fascist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to say if there's any questions too. Last chance out there for people who want to put questions in the comments. On theme, yeah, I agree. I think there are lots of ways of often I find that taking a really broad approach to what the theme is instead of a sort of didactic, the moral of the story approach tends to work, you know. So with The Road to Canterbury, I decided that the theme was peace, and of course how you interpret what peace means politically, personally, otherwise is kind of up to the player, but it would always sort of bring that back, and that gives it a little bit of a sense of coherence, is that, you know, it always sort of comes back to that theme in a different way.
I mean, I tend to find, I suppose maybe it's because of the kind of writing I do or the way I've ended up writing, somewhat scattered and haphazard. I tend to find more generally in my interactive work and otherwise that my thematic concerns tend to emerge as I'm writing. I don't even realize that what I'm writing about is something until I get to a certain point, or even sometimes when I got to the end.
Yeah, it's done.
And then I look back and go, ha! Hey, look, I had a message there. Great.
I was thinking about something.
I always find that really interesting as well, just from a lit crit point of view, when people look at other people's work and talk about, you know, the author's intention. I always think, it's not always quite that straightforward, is it?
Yeah. And it's really interesting to see that happen with role-playing games too, when you have a group of people developing a theme. And like, I don't play a lot, but other people in my family do. And even the few times that I have played, it's, you know, just having a party of people and over the course of an evening, you can see, okay, well, things keep cropping up, the same ideas keep cropping up, or the same sort of motifs keep cropping up in the story. And maybe we're just all in that headspace or whatever, but a theme can develop that way too, really organically.
I love that though. I love the way these things can emerge collaboratively. And that's something I'm really interested in developing. I think this is where the interactive form is really interesting, because there is space for collaborative storytelling.
Kate, I wanted to ask you to elaborate a little more on, so you said your theme was peace, which I really like. How did you implement it, and in what different ways, like where did it branch, and how did that change what peace was?
So It's been a few years since I wrote it, so forgive me if I forget things. But you know, the sort of basic setting is because it's at the very beginning of the Hundred Years' War, and there are rumblings of the peasant revolt happening around that time as well. And so there's a lot of sort of political opportunities for political upheaval and warfare starting and that kind of thing. It's in 14th century England. And so I did have kind of just a basic backstory about that built in, that, you know, there was, you know, an element of the character's life that they had not made peace with. And there was peace in a political sense. And there was a sort of, you know, spiritual peace and all of these other elements of what that might mean and how they might fit together. And so you could kind of prioritize those as a player and like, how will you make peace with this element of your family backstory? And it could be, you know, turning your back on it, or it could be, you know, trying to confront it kind of thing. And both of them could lead you to peace. And so that's where you get to that sort of multiplicity of satisfactory endings, because you can find a different kind of peace in each path, but you're going to get there differently, and it's going to mean something a little bit different.
I like that a lot. That's not what I was expecting you to say. That's cool.
Yeah. And I'm a political science nerd, so I have a political science degree. So I had a lot of kind of other stuff in there too about...
I would have guessed history. I was like, this girl.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of, well, how, you know, how can you avoid, you know, and it's a little bit difficult in a historical setting because the player knows, probably the player knows that, okay, you know, the Hundred Years' War is going to happen, you know, so you're not going to prevent that, but that's not really what's at stake. But how can you as a person work towards peace in that context? And what does that mean? And are you going to choose diplomacy? Are you going to choose, you know, to take up arms and go that way? And, you know, is there any small thing you can do behind the scenes to actually change life for people and make people less likely to be victims of this of warfare and that kind of thing? And so definitely that part came into it as well. Ooh, my cat has opinions.
So does mine. Yes. So wrapping up for our final 5 minutes, I guess anything you want to say to close out or even to promote your work, I'd love to hear about it. And then also, I guess, where would we like to see the interactive space to go going into the future?
You can buy my book, Family Curse, on my Linktree, which is on my Twitter or my Instagram. I think my Twitter was shared around in the promo for this, including my own promo for this, like, before. And you can just, like, find it. I feel like maybe, will they be posting our links after this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, check that on out. It's a primary source document mystery. You can be a historian as you piece together the curse on this family. And I really hope that development of game and theater becomes more developed later on. Like, I'd love to go to, like, Sleep No More with, like, an app, you know, putting little, like, extra magical elements into the theater.
Yeah, so I've talked a lot about my first project with Choice of Games, The Road to Canterbury. My second one with them is called The Magician's Workshop, and that's set in Florence in the time of Leonardo da Vinci, and there's magic. You can also find links to those and all of my books and my Assassin's Creed books as well on my website, which is katehardfield.com. And my Twitter is Kate Hardfield. I'm Kate Hardfield everywhere. I'm on Mastodon. So yeah, you can find me pretty easily. In terms of where I'd like it to go, I think, you know, as we've been talking about the sort of different collaborations between different media and different communities of artists, I think is really exciting. And also, I think using the accessibility tools that we've developed during the pandemic and maintaining that, you know, as Katie was talking about earlier, to connect people across continents and, you know, people who can't leave their houses for whatever reason, you know, using that to increase the accessibility of interactive fiction would be great as well.
People should come see us at Flights of Foundry also.
Yes.
Tenacity and I are going to be at Flights of Foundry, which is a wonderful multi-genre, multi-medium convention in April.
Yeah, sounds good.
So We are taking submissions for Void Space 6 at the moment. Subs close on the 7th of April, and the issue is going to drop on the 15th. We publish quarterly numbered editions that have interactive work in them. In between, we publish pop-ups, which is where if an interactive artist has created a tool for others to use, so we've had a blackout poetry creation tool, we've had some really fun things, and then I'll then issue an invitation for all writers of all kinds to collaborate and move towards a pop-up. So check me out on Void Space Zine. Our first hard copy book sprawl is coming out hopefully in June. There's a whole world of excitement coming from that. And also do feel free also to check out my personal Twitter. It's Void Scrawl with a K, and that has links to my own writing, including my own interactive work. In terms of what I'd like to see for the future, I would like to see interactive storytelling to become a part of writers' toolkits, theatre makers' toolkits, filmmakers' toolkits, to break out of the niche and be a tool that is used as widely as possible to open up as many perspectives as possible. And I think, you know, the work we're doing here and in other spaces is hopefully going to bring us one day towards that.
And I'm Jules Pilarski. I just published my first volume in an interactive series about time travel called Tempest Fugit. And you can find me on Twitter and my work on playtempestfugit.com. And I'm working on the second volume in that series, which will hopefully be out in August. Where I would like the space to go. I would love to see like almost the opposite of what Tenacity is talking about. Instead of like an app at Sleep No More, I would like a book to come to life and like you go meet in some sort of underground speakeasy or whatever. And also, like the capitalistic horror of this is like everywhere now, especially with AI. I'm seeing like advertising is about storytelling, and I mean, I don't want to get involved in an immersive game about Fruit Loops, but I think that like the potential is out there to like have a lot of fun, and I like hope that like some cool ideas get into the game in that way. Also, we didn't talk much about radio and podcasting. I think that has great potential in the interactive space. I used to use Zombies Run by, the girl who wrote The Power, Natalie Alderman. And it's like it told you a story about zombies chasing you as you ran. That was great fun. It was the only thing that made me run. Love stuff like that. So thank you guys for joining us today. I had a great time. Really nice talking to you. Thank you, SFF Addicts, for hosting us.
Yeah.
Thank you. You did a great job. Thanks, Jules.
Thank you.
Thank you.